trying to turn everyone into a speaker, but I see that that may be kicking you out of the web conference, so I'm going to leave you back as you were. Let me see. So every time I touch something, it just messes it up. Well, I'm not going to touch anything else. I'm just going to leave it as is. Elena, you're here. Jesus, Gabriela, Cesar. Hopefully Carlos will come back on in a second. Well, we're going to deal today with Walt Whitman. I don't know if you remember what we talked about last week regarding the order that we were going to follow with the authors. So let me see if I can we did a change to the natural order here. We did Edgar Allan Poe first. This is still wrong in this version. I don't know how many times I've changed it, but apparently this is not right. We did Edgar Allan Poe on the 4th and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow on the 11th. I'll have that fixed for next week in case you want to go back to the recordings and check that out. Let me see if everybody is finally back on. I'm still missing Carlos that I unfortunately kicked out, and there's another student that left, but I think that wasn't me. Let's see if Carlos comes back online. Regarding the authors that we're going to cover over the next 2 weeks, we're going to do Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson in the first place. This will allow us to cover poetry before the end of the semester. Before the spring break, and that will give you sufficient time to work on the PEC, especially on the second part that you need. Maybe a bit more time. The deadline of the PEC is April the 15th. I don't know if the sound quality is as good as the other day. Just checking with that. I made it. Yes, I'm not going to touch anything, Carlos, because and Marimar, I kicked you out by accident because I turned you into speakers because I just wanted to, in case somebody has interaction with the camera and all that. Apparently, it makes them go out of the environment and come back in. But well, if you touch the screen from now on, you're touching my screen. So careful with that. Okay, don't do it. Exactly. so just watch and let me control it. I've been trying to do some fancy stuff. Yeah, Carlos, please. This is hard enough as it is. I've been trying to do some fancy stuff, like embed a couple of videos. Last year when we were in the classroom environment, I just posted the YouTube links, but I was thinking that since I'm at home and I have this tablet here with me and the sound quality is pretty good, I'm going to just play it for you guys. I'm going to look for the presentation in real time, and I want to play you a couple of videos of Walt Whitman, because let's face it. If I told you, tell me a couple of poems from Spanish poetry, I would start to hear mumbles and people looking at the ceiling and trying to not be asked about it. We're not very good at learning poetry or at remembering poetry as something universal. And maybe some of us know a couple of poems by Rubén Darío or a poem here and there from Miguel Hernández or something from Federico García Lorca or Gloria Fuertes. But the generality is that it's not very common to know poems and to find poems as something, as something that, that daily, part of daily knowledge, to say it in an easy way. In this case, I think that because of pop culture, because of, traditional culture, we're more fortunate. Let me see if I can open this in PowerPoint. There you go. We're more fortunate in the case of Whitman. Whitman is a well-known poet thanks to the Dead Poet Society. Whitman is a very relevant part of the movie. And I don't know if you remember that movie, if you've watched the movie many times, if you watched it in English even, but the movie is full of allusions and refers to Whitman very strongly. What does Whitman represent for American literature? Whitman represents the coming of age of American poetry. Let's write that here, coming of age. Okay, because let's face it, up to the moment where Whitman and Dickinson appear, Whitman appears over the course of many years and produces an incredible body of work. Let me show you, his initial poem is a short volume of a few poems. Now, this is my copy of Leaves of Grass, the entire edition. And as you can see, it's a pretty thick book. This is Walt Whitman's only production. He decided to copyright the name, in this case, this tome called Leaves of Grass. And what he did in every edition was to expand it. He would republish everything that had been previously published, and he extended it with what he called collections. Okay, so for example, there is a collection dedicated to the Civil War called Drum Taps. You can see that over here. Before Drum Taps, probably by the roadside, some of his most famous poems are here. One we're going to read, that we're going to watch, that's the short clip, that short video clip, O Me, O Life. And right below it, I would say, or not very far from it, maybe that's on a different page. O Captain, My Captain, which is a famous poem that is used in the Dead Poets Society. I couldn't remember the name of the movie. Here you can see it. O Captain, My Captain. This is a tribute to President Lincoln upon his death. So as you can see, Whitman brought poetry to the American masses in a time of extreme turmoil. Dead Poets Society, exactly. If you think about the period where Whitman lived, 1819 to 1892, it's a period that has the big explosion of American culture, but it also has the American Civil War that is probably one of the most traumatic events for several generations. And besides that, the death of Abraham Lincoln killed at a theater. Without further ado, I'm going to go to the next slide. I normally don't use this type of pop cultural reference when I talk about 18th, 19th century literature and poetry, because I just don't have the opportunity. I don't have that many examples to feed upon to give you significant feedback. I don't know if the light is maybe too bright. Yeah, I'm gonna move it that way. Yeah, there you go. But in this case, this is as you can see on the right of this slide, you can see part of the Dead Poets Society script. This is the original script, and these are lines from the script. These are lines from the script that we can, that I'm going to try to reproduce. I'm not very sure because I haven't tried this before. I've tried it on my PC, but I'm not very sure if this is going to work here. Well, it doesn't seem to want to work right now. So I'm not going to be able to make, to help you, watch it, but at least we can listen to it. I think that if we, that if I play it, you should be able to listen to it. Let me see if I can do that now. One moment. There are two, this is the first time I see a reference to a film in a literature class. I hope it's not a disappointing reference. In this case, what Professor Keating is trying to instill in his poetry, in his class, is the importance of poetry for the people. And that's something that I think that Walt Whitman achieved, and that's why I like this example, and that's why I use this example in an unapologetic way. I think that the example that Professor Keaton shows in the movie is very significant in terms of the reality. Well, that's I'm glad I'm making a high school dream come true. or an aspiration. In the case of Professor Keaton, he's trying to make his students not survive a literature course, but to love literature, and that is what literature is all about. And sometimes the importance of literature is overlooked because of its practicality in life. And I'm going to use two examples. One is from a movie, and if you think that that is pop culture, wait until I play the second part of the clip. The first part is Professor Keaton talking to his students and telling them why reading and writing poetry is important. Let's see if you can hear this well.
Words and ideas can change the world. See, look at Mr. Pitt's eye.
The sound is very bad. What I'll do is if I can't make this work, I'll post this afterwards in the forum with the two clips, because they're easy to embed. Taking them from the internet. Basically, what we have above is Professor Keaton explaining why poetry is important. And I think this is a very good introduction to Walt Whitman. Why? What did Walt Whitman want to achieve in life? He wanted to become relevant. He wanted poetry to be relevant. He wanted poetry to be for every American. He wanted to democratize poetry, not for poetry to be something that was reserved for the exclusive elites, but for poetry to be something open for everyone. And this speech is so inspiring and so connected to one of Walt Whitman's poems that I thought it was a good introduction. I don't know if I've managed to. No, I haven't. Because this same clip of audio is used afterwards. It was used in 2011, and you would say, who would use a clip of a movie about early 20th century life at a boarding school? Why would that ever be important for a commercial? Well, the commercial is by Apple, and the commercial is the introduction of the first iPad. They chose this same speech by Robin Williams because it's very inspiring. It says that we read and write poetry because it connects us to what the human being is. It makes it, it helps us understand humanity. And that's what poetry is actually about. It's about understanding humanity and understanding life. And that's what Walt Whitman wanted to achieve. He wanted to achieve a poetry that would appeal to everyone, to the worker, to the middle class person. Tries to imitate Marlon Brando. Well, that's a mistake from the, clear mistake from the movie. He wants to, Whitman aspires to make, to make poetry for everyone, for actresses, for bankers, for bakers, for prostitutes. And you're going to say, wow, why did he come up with the term of prostitute in a literature class? Probably the first time we've talked about prostitution in a literature class. No, because we've already covered Edgar Allan Poe. But the case is that there are no taboo topics for Whitman, because Whitman wants to use poetry as a vehicle to describe the world and describe life. And to describe life, you can't leave elements out, and you can't say that there are themes that are poetic and themes that are not poetic. And I think that is the key takeaway that you should walk away with. Everything is poetic. There are no poetic, there are no non-poetic themes. Everything is poetic. I don't know if I'm going to have space here to write this with my lousy writing on this tablet. Let's get into Walt Whitman as an author, and what our objectives for the courses, for today's class is going to be. The first thing that we want to achieve in this in this lesson is see how Whitman is a revolutionary. He's a revolutionary of American literature from the point of view that he's taking a literary movement that already exists. He is not doing anything different to what other authors are doing, but in prose. But he's taking all of that sophistication, all of that innovation, all of that experimentation to the grounds of poetry. And this revolutionary American poetry does is reject conventional English poetry, and it substitutes it with an American speech, with an American voice. And therefore, you have to tread untread grounds. And what are those untread grounds? All the topics that are considered unworthy of poetry. What themes would those be? For example, sexuality. Walt Whitman is going to be probably the first overtly homosexual author that we're going to study in the course, and probably at an age where homosexuality was considered blasphemous and a source of scandal. He ends up embracing his sexual difference and also the liberty and the freedom in sexuality. So that's going to be one of the open topics and one of the mainstream topics for Whitman's poetry. Another one, gender, equal rights for men and women, something that sounds absolutely revolutionary, but at the time where he is proposing it, for sure it is an idea that is not mainstream at all, and is very brave, and costs him all sorts of problems with his reputation, criticism, job opportunities. The cost that he suffers as an individual is extremely high. We're also going to see that it has an open stance in terms of abolitionism. We come from studying Longfellow, and his way of trying to maintain a middle ground in terms of abolitionism. And Longfellow was criticized for that because he neither openly embraced abolitionism or he did not get on the side of people that defended slavery rights. So there is going to be a lot of criticism for Longfellow in that case. If we contrast him with Whitman, the contrast is going to leave Longfellow in a very bad place, because we have the undeterred bravery of Whitman in terms of openly standing against slavery, embracing abolitionism, versus Longfellow's attempt to establish a middle ground between slavery and abolitionism. Whitman has all the background of a self-made man, and there in him we can find the democratic ideals, and this ordinary background said with all the positive tone that ordinary can carry. Ordinary is a way of referring to his upbringing, but by no means does that mean that it's a derogatory term. Ordinary as a positive element of his way of rising from a very humble position to a position of recognition. That recognition, however, is not instantaneous, and he barely witnessed it. He did not gain a fortune. He did gain a certain amount of reputation during his life, but only at the end of his life was the body of his poetry truly recognized and truly established. We're going to see how Whitman not only takes a stance in terms of slavery, but also takes a political stance and uses his voice to the world, which is his poetry, to speak about the anti-slavery movement and or the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and all that effect that it, all that resonate all that resonation that these events had on his life are expressed in his poetry. So we're going to see that his poetry serves as a chronicle of the time, and he lived a significant part of the 19th century, from the very beginning, from 1819 all the way to 1891, which is going to give us a vast and very extensive view of what the century was like. We're going to focus on Leaves of Grass, his works that went from 12 poems to include the body or the corpus of 389 poems 37 years later, and what I expressed before as collections. There is one poem in particular that is incredibly long, Song of Myself. It's like an epic. It has a tone of an epic poem, but at the same time, it has this sense of trying to describe normality and everyday situations. It is written in very different and experimental tones, and we're going to see how it expresses what Whitman is. This Song of Myself is opening his heart from the poetic point of view. It expresses the author's personality, his symbolic view of what society should be, and there are powerful images throughout the text that are very well portrayed because of one of Whitman's most significant innovations or ideas that he embraced, that of free verse. By dropping the poetic structure that we're used to experiencing, he embraced other forms of poetry, as we will see afterwards. Walt Whitman was born in the state of New York. He was immediately nicknamed Walt as a way of distinguishing him from his father. He left the school at the age of 11, and that did not mean that he did not have an ample education. His education spanned over the course. Let me see if this has done anything. I don't see it has. Well, that's disappointing. He read very much, and among those authors, those more relevant authors that he read, we can find Shakespeare, we can find Homer, and we can find Dante. That leads us to imagining an author that has a very significant and a very broad literary education that is going to allow him to have ideas of his own. That besides that, he was a huge follower of both theater and opera, and he thought that those two elements shaped his thought and his view on the world. He was influenced by Quakerism and Deism, the prevailing ideas in his household, though his parents were not extremely religious. What does this mean? That we're going to have a conflict regarding, for example, Edgar Allan Poe, and this is one of the interesting things about Romanticism. There are no absolutes that we can say Romanticism. One of the things that we said regarding Edgar Allan Poe was that he did not believe in a didactic purpose, a purpose for literature. He believed in art for art's sake. I think that probably Hawthorne and Melville were more on Poe's side. I wouldn't say absolutely, but they would tend to agree more with Poe's view of the world. However, if we take into consideration what Whitman thought or what Emerson thought, there is a significantly marked a didactic purpose to his writing. Walt Whitman didn't want to only write his poetry. He didn't want to share his thoughts. He wanted to shape reality. He wanted to shape the American culture for the American society. So I think that's a very significant difference regarding other authors of the time, and especially the authors that had a very strong position that is in opposition to Walt Whitman. I wouldn't say that Walt Whitman opposed Edgar Allan Poe's idea on all levels. I would say that this is a very significant difference between the two of them, but it's not a difference that that affects other elements that would allow us to not consider Walt Whitman as romantic as the other three authors. So whenever you have to establish comparisons and contrast between the poetry of the 19th century, a very clear one would be that Walt Whitman did believe in the purpose, in the didactic purpose, or in the utility of poetry as a way of shaping American morals and American society, as a way of educating people. And Edgar Allan Poe just did not think that was an element that was of any interest to him, or should be to any author. He thought that art should be created for the sake of art. But it's not uncommon to see those type of discrepancies in one same literary movement. That's why I think that it's interesting to mention that even within Romanticism, which is easy to portray in certain aspects, some aspects such as the purpose of writing is you get very divergent opinions. Some authors you cannot come to a conclusion whether they believed in a didactic purpose for writing. Others you can come to that conclusions, and others you just have to hold some type of middle ground. Okay, let me see. I think I've finally managed to make this work. Okay, well, let me see how well you can see this. Okay, yeah, not bad. I'm going to play it full volume, and I just want to remind you that this is from the Dead Poets Society. If you haven't watched a movie, it's very recommendable for these days. And this is just to show you the importance that Whitman has gained in contemporary culture, thanks to the reinstatement or the dignification. We normally all do, yes. The dignification of poetry, which was not a dignified thing. If you remember, Longfellow had to fight against that concept that, for whatever reason, poetry was considered an effeminate art, especially in America, where it did not have the reputation that it held, for example, in English territory. So here we're going to have to go against this this ideal that poetry is something for ladies. It's a romantic thing. It's not a serious business. Let me see if you find this passage inspiring, because Walt Whitman is at the center of it. Isn't this disappointing? Now the volume doesn't work. So we can see the video, but the volume doesn't work. So yeah, I'll just post the videos, and that way you have like an extended bonus track for the class. I'm sorry. I tried my best. I've been multitasking here while I was talking and trying to not lose the pace of what I was saying. But so much for that. I wasn't very lucky. Okay, so going back to what I said. Anyway, expect a message from me today in the forum with those two clips and the picture of the script, so you can follow it at home and come to your own conclusions and maybe create a debate. For example, today we're lucky we have Constance in class. She normally can't come to class. She sent me a couple of interesting questions by email. I would really love to read more about your opinions and for you to create debates in our forum, and that's another way of studying, just to exchange ideas and to contrast ideas or exploratory questions from the textbook. That's just another way of advancing in the unit. Please start your debates and I'll observe and I'll try to chip in and also give my point of view. But I mean, allowing you to express your ideas, because you're the protagonist. I'm just here to walk you through this experience of discovering American literature. Well, going back to Whitman in his life, in his early life up to his 20s, he worked as a journalist. Remember that these people normally they left school very early. Whitman at the age of 11, they had to start working, and he picked up all kinds of jobs: journalist, a teacher, government clerk, and a volunteer nurse during the American Civil War. One of the key elements of that influences Whitman, and here we go again, it's Emerson. When Emerson lectures one of his speech as a poet in New York, Whitman is blown away from hearing Emerson deliver that speech, and he becomes very inspired by Emerson. In fact, Emerson is considered one of Walt Whitman's primary references and literary influencers. He was driven away from the Democratic Party for his views on slavery. Remember that things were very, very different to today. The Democratic Party was had a very solid point of view in favor of slavery, and the Republican Party was completely against slavery, and that's why Abraham Lincoln, who belonged to the Republican Party, had such a strong view on the matter. So there was a divided nation, such as the type of divided nation that we would think about nowadays in the United States, but the actors or the contenders had switched roles regarding now. The Democratic Party nowadays is considered to be the defender of inequality, fighting for racial justice, gender equality, etc., etc., while the Republican Party has moved towards a more conservative point of view and less signified on terms of defending social and civil rights. He became an active member of the Free Soil Party, which is a significantly anti-capitalist movement that tries to avoid having any hereditary rights over land, and for land to be freely disposed by whoever has the opportunity and the energy to work the land, which is a kind of leftist idea. So you can see that the ideas that are now considered mainstream within the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in that time, they were basically switched. Okay, that's interesting. Good idea, Constance. The first edition of Leaves of Grass came in his 30s, when he was almost 36, if I don't recall incorrectly, and seven editions would follow. Those seven editions would just increase the extension of the initial work. During the Civil War, he was affected profoundly. He did not serve in the Civil War as a soldier. He served in medical attention as a man nurse, and he was extremely shocked by the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. From his works, there is one significant work, Drum Taps, which is a collection of poems about the Civil War, and it was published at that time. The sexuality, one of the key topics that we've said, there are three themes that are going to be very, very significant for Walt Whitman, but at the same time, they're going to be very controversial for his life and for his reputation, how society labels him and accepts him. These three themes are sexuality, gender, and the fight against slavery. The topic of sexuality is an entire is a pillar of Whitman's ideas, and his homosexuality is embraced as his writing career advances. So at the beginning, there is a succinct acceptance of sexual, I don't want to say deviation because I really hate the word. I hate that the idea of straightness and deviance, because I really don't think sexuality can be labeled with those two words. It sounds so old fashioned, and I wouldn't even say 20th century, 19th century, or 18th century. but of sexual difference regarding the heterosexuality. This idea of how important unveiling his sexuality was is very important to understand his poetry and the symbolism in the poetry. If you read into this, into the symbols that you read there, some of them have a very, very clear sexual, very clear sexual reference. And when you understand the situation, you accept it much better. I don't really know. That's a very good question. But I'm imagining that not very much. Homosexuality was prosecuted in many states of America. It still is, in fact. There are still one or two states where homosexuals cannot live under the same roof openly. And I have no explanation for that. I think that if we put this in the perspective of the mid 19th century, we're going to see that homosexuality is something that can never be openly acceptable. But also we have to accept, especially when we study other authors like Kate Chopin at the end of this semester, that male homosexuality was more tolerated than female homosexuality. There was a word for homosexual men, which were gay men, and gay means happy. It's a synonym of happy. So this euphemism of gay men that afterwards was embraced by homosexuals as a way of ridiculing the label itself and saying that they openly accepted gay as a way of reference of referring to themselves. I don't think there was any possibility of leading a openly homosexual life. Such as the standards that we're used to right now. You have to just have a look at certain countries not very far away from Spain to understand how not understood and persecuted and prosecuted homosexuality still is, unfortunately. In 1882, because of these ideas, because of what could be read in between the lines, or not even in between the lines, openly, it could be read openly. Leaves of Grass is denounced as obscene and asked to be removed from sale. I think that in the second semester we have like half a dozen works. Probably his inner circle did accept it. Probably, but again, we still see cases where homosexuality is not even accepted within the family circle or the circle of friends, and it's seen as, I don't know, a disease of some type that can be cured, and all those type of very old fashioned sentiment. Think that we're not even in the 20th century, so how brave do you have to be to little by little, embrace that reality and come out of the closet, as is popularly said, when there is no one that is openly saying the same things as you were saying. In the case of, for example, if we refer to English literature, in the case of Oscar Wilde, I think that we can see a different but parallel example. Maybe Oscar Wilde was more openly homosexual in terms of not disguising the way he wanted to dress or the way he wanted to express himself. In the case of Walt Whitman, there was his poetry that stated that. But there wasn't an attached attire that was meant to cause uproar or any kind of scandal because it was out of the norm. Walt Whitman was was not seen as homosexual until he decided to openly talk about his sexuality. And I think that from that point of view, it's a very significant, because it's a unique case within the 19th century literature. And there, I can do some research and maybe come back to you in the next class, and we can talk about the concepts or the signs the in his life regarding homosexuality. In the case of Emily Dickinson that we're going to talk about next week, as in the case of Edgar Allan Poe, everything is a guessing game. In the case of Emily Dickinson, it's even a bigger guessing game, because we only have her letters to shape her chain of thought, her letters and her work, because nobody had firsthand experience with Emily Dickinson except her family. And there are also some theories that talk about Emily Dickinson's covert sexual preferences and maybe a more hidden homosexuality, which has not there are not significant facts that can lead us to say that is true or that is false. It's just a theory that has to remain unsolved. In the case of What Women, we're positive, as we are in the case of Oscar Wilde, that they embrace their sexuality to a certain extent. I think that Walt Whitman, all the way, he went all in this case. And we have to accept, as one of the key elements when we describe Walt Whitman, his bravery to embrace his sexuality, even in the face of all the consequences that he knew for sure were going to go attached to recognizing his sexual differences towards the general expectations of society of the time. At the end of his life, he suffered from a stroke, and his health declined, and he died at the age of 72. His dream was to be the poet of the people, the poet of the Americans. And I don't think that he never fully felt embraced by the audience or by the readership. And probably, as is always the case, he was only rewarded with a huge attendance on the day of his funeral. The day of his funeral became a public spectacle, and one that was significantly crowded. Because he had achieved what very few thought was possible, which was literary recognition within his lifetime for writing poetry, and only poetry. There is no serious attempt to walk outside of the barriers of poetry. And only after his death was he fully recognized by the public. Regarding his works, we've talked about his experimental, and probably that's one of the words that we're going to have to highlight here. We're going to have to highlight this idea of experimental. After experimenting with other genres, he found his way in poetry. And I think that this idea of experiment is the idea that connects us to Whitman. And from this experimentation, the biggest element that comes here is free verse. Let me remind you that he studied the classics. He was knowledgeable in Shakespeare and Homer and in Dante especially. He embraced free verse as a way of creating a work of art that is based on natural speech and the cadence of the Bible, which is a really interesting concept. This cadence of the Bible is called the free flow. It's the rhythm at which Bible reading was normally conducted, and this free flow is the rhythm that he tries to achieve with his free verse. It tries to imitate the way that people speak, or rather the way that people read. Verse lines have different length and no regular meter. So we're degrading in importance the length, the meter, and of course a rhyme. We're killing all of the saint, trinity of traditional poetry. We're not paying attention to length. We're not paying attention to meter, and we're not paying attention to rhyme. Does that mean that the difficulty in writing poetry is over? By no means. His poetry was very well thought and very worked. And if you and you'll have the opportunity to continue studying a free verse when you study contemporary American literature, and you'll see how a free verse is as elaborate as regular verse, rhymed verse, because it's because the search for the message, the search for the style, is as laborious as the search for the appropriate line, the appropriate length, the appropriate the choice of words, or the appropriate amount of feet and distribution of words. Whitman was so confident about his work that he published Leaves of Grass, the first volume of 12 poems, with his own money. And he did something that was a bit novel for the time. He copyrighted his work. So from the very beginning, he had the authorial rights over his work. And he continued to expand Leaves of Grass from 1855 until his death, revising, changing poems from the already published poems, and expanding the collection. The total body of his work reaches 389 poems in this seventh edition. And his idea was to deliver an American epic. And I think I've used these two words at the beginning of the class. Epic is a way of referring to his work that I think is a very is very faithful to what he wanted to convey with his work. Some of his poems, because I think because of a lack of or because he wasn't sure if he had found his poetic voice, or he was still experimenting, or there were some ideas that he didn't know if he could throw to the public, were published anonymously in the New York Mirror at a very early age, at the age of 14 or 15, if I don't recall incorrectly. The importance of Whitman and Emily Dickinson. This is a two-part slide, because I'm going to establish this importance first, and the next week I'm going to give you elements to compare and contrast Whitman and Dickinson in particular, which is especially interesting for you that have to produce a peck about these two authors and Longfellow and their work. Both of them are the most important poets of the 19th century American literature. They created a new language, a new poetic language, and read in the light or in comparison to Longfellow, it shows us how far American literature and American poetry in particular evolved over a very short period of time. Walt Whitman published openly during his entire lifetime. Emily Dickinson published in private, published for her family, therefore didn't publish her work, which was meant to be destroyed upon her death. But that last will was fortunately not fulfilled. Her work has reached the public. American poetry, thanks to Whitman and Dickinson, became truly American, and had two major authors that had authoritative voices in the light of universal literature. We were talking before that we were missing those big names in American literature. We've been creating them over the course of the last months, since we started the second semester. We have Nathaniel Hawthorne and the first great American novel, The Scarlet Letter. Afterwards, we have Herman Melville and probably the greatest novel in American literature and one of the most important novels in English, in literature, in the English language. Afterwards, we have Edgar Allan Poe that expanded the reaches of expanded and stretched the reaches and the dominions of Romanticism as far as could possibly be done. And at the same time, we have this internal tension of the utility of literature that is established between the Romantics, between the Transcendentalist Romantics, Emerson and Thoreau, and these darker Romantics, especially Edgar Allan Poe. And now we have these two enormous juggernauts of poetry, which are Whitman and Emily Dickinson, that have nothing that stand any type of comparison with any type of poet in English history. So Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson are major figures of English poetry, of poetry in the English language, not only in American literature. And that canonical status that established them as key figures is what made American literature significant. And we're going to see that there are going to be generations and generations of authors that are going to benefit from this newly discovered ground that Whitman and Emily Dickinson so clearly leave open for the rest, for the modernist, for T.S. Eliot, for the Beat Generation, for the postmodernist. Everything began with Whitman and Dickinson. Before Whitman and Dickinson, well, we've seen how Edgar Allan Poe has produced some interesting poetry. Before them, everything was repetition and following schemes that were imported from English literature. In the case of Whitman and Dickinson, it is distinctly American and universally major, universally important. They both reached through different creative processes their style. And their style was what American poetry would be all about in the 20th century. It was making it new. And this is a motto of modernism. So Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, from the point of view of poetry, they're fringe creators, because they have so many tints of modernism that you can call them proto-modernist, or you can call them tardo-romantic. They accept both ways of being categorized. Whitman and Emily Dickinson leave the ground of how to make new poetry, but in absolutely divergent ways. So even though we're comparing Whitman and Dickinson on one point of view, and we're establishing that Longfellow is basically on a different, it belongs to a different category of poets, a minor category of poets for sure, we're also going to have to distinguish between Whitman and Dickinson because of their style. One of the elements of Whitman is that we're going to see that there is one element that is extremely significant. It's expansive. If I have to talk about Whitman in any with one single word, I would say that his poetry is expansive, and Emily Dickinson is compressed. Whitman wrote for the people, for everyone. Emily Dickinson wrote for her heart. So these ideas is Whitman looks outward, and Emily Dickinson looks inward. And Walt Whitman tries to create a poem that works as a shockwave, and Emily Dickinson creates compressed, intimate poems that soothe the inner voice that we all have inside ourselves. So it's going to be very interesting, because we're going to contrast in 2 weeks two of the most important poets of American literature, and we're going to contrast how similar they are in some aspects, but how significantly different they are in other aspects. And what comes right after is really important. They're a withstanding influence, and that's why I wanted to use the examples that I used at the beginning. How Walt Whitman had a way of finding himself into an Oscar winning movie where you're not used to seeing poetry used as something appealing for the general audience or even for moviegoers or younger generations, and how Whitman is seen as a different, transformative kind of artist, and how his influence is felt so much that it's even being used to promote something as completely different to the times of Walt Whitman as an Apple device for navigating on the internet and being productive. The Apple iPad used the same speech that Professor Keating uses in the Dead Poets Society to express a completely different idea. How poetry is the inner voice that tells us, that connects us to our humanity, and how that connection to humanity is what allows us to do the big things in life. And these ideas that Whitman talks to the people to give them a voice to feel great and to feel that poetry is the answer to everything. Emily Dickinson uses poetry as an inner voice, as a way of talking to herself and coming to explanations about the things that she experiences, but also the things that she imagines. That's what's so interesting about Emily Dickinson's different worlds of Dickinson, her various narrative personas. But we'll get there the following week. It's probably too early to talk so much about Emily Dickinson. The idea of making it new is the American poetic motto of the 20th century. But even before it was a poetic motto, it was already happening with the Whitman and Dickinson. The previous poetic canon that Whitman and Dickinson smashed and destroyed forever favored traditional rhyming and meter, and we can find it in Emerson, in Longfellow, and even in Edgar Allan Poe. It is Emerson who calls for ending this dependence of English led intellectualism and calls for a fully American intellectual independence. Whitman speaks of democracy, of man and humanity, and Dickinson speaks about her inner feelings and her inner imagination, her inner worlds. So the importance of Dickinson and Whitman is very, very significant and must be understood in a connected way. We're going to read the first part that we're going to read is from a Song of Myself. We're going to read seven sections. I have a book over here. Let me see if how good are we doing on time? 1 hour. Okay, not bad. We have 25 minutes to read through the poems. I think we'll have more than enough time. I'm going to ask you to please go to page 360-something. Yeah. 360. Okay, yeah. As you can see, every section has its own personality. And this is what's interesting about this poem, Song of Myself. It's actually many poems inside one poem. It's a collection of all the thoughts that Whitman attributes to himself. We're going to read sections 1, 6, 15, 16, 17, 51, and 52. Okay? Without further ado, let me read from page 360, Professor Gibert's introduction out of the 52 sections of the 1881 version of Song of Myself. So as you can see, we're going to read the very end of the poem and the beginning. So the beginning, it begins with a, I celebrate myself, and it comes with a spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. You can see that it starts and ends in with a completely different tone. One is talking about himself, and the other one is about how society is having a point of view of about the author. Or it could be another interpretation. That's my interpretation, but it could be another interpretation. So let me read from Professor Gibert's introduction. Out of the 52 sections of the 1881 version of Song of Myself, Whitman's best-known poem, we're going to read only 7, including the first one and the last two. The text coincides with a so-called deathbed edition. The deathbed edition is the last edition, which the author wanted to absolutely supersede all the previous ones. When we read Song of Myself in the 1881 version, however, we are not seeing exactly the same poem that readers first saw in 1855, which was untitled and was not divided into sections. The final version that we will read presents slight changes of phrasing and has the sections numbers added by the author. So as you can see, even the poems that had already been published were revised, revisited, and rehashed in different ways. The first poem did not have sections. This one did. From Song of Myself, 1881, Part 1. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume you shall assume. For every atom belongs to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from the soil, this air. Born here of parents, born here from parents the same, and their parents the same. I now, 37 years old, in perfect health begin, hoping to seize not until death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back in a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard. Nature without checking, with original energy. As you can see, the style of the lines, they vary very much, and sometimes you think you have a perfect understanding of the focus of the text, and sometimes you have the opposite feeling, that you've lost the focus of what he wants to say, and only upon a different reading can you come to a conclusion of, oh, I think I know what he means. So this is the elusiveness of Whitman. We were talking about the elusiveness of the romantic prose writers. There's also a lot of elusiveness in the way that Whitman talks about his poetry. Part 6. A child said, "What is grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven, or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and a remembrancer, designingly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners that we may see and remark, and says, whose? Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white folks. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman Cuff, I give them the same, I receive them the same, and now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. Tenderly while I use your curling hair, it may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you are from old people or from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps, and here you are the mother's laps. This grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive after all so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouth for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men or women, and the hints about old men and mothers and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life, and does not wait at the end to arrest it, and seize the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. I really like this section, and this section is incredibly overt in terms of his embracing homosexuality, and he especially lines 14 and 15 are probably the most clearly homosexual writing you can trace this early in American literature. And I think it's very difficult to come to a different conclusion when you read those two lines that it's a homosexual thought, or it's a sexualized thought of young men and their breasts, which is a unusual connection. The idea that I find here, and maybe you can remember, is that this section reminds me very much to some concepts of that we read in the song to Hamatreya in Emerson, where he talks about how the earth is a revolving element where the people come and go, and only nature remains as a universal thing. I tend to see the same in things that he says, that grass is something that grows back and grows back, and how he connects it to his idea of the Lord, but he comes to different conclusions and always in an elusive manner. There are some verses that are very beautiful, like, for example, how he connects the idea of grass as the beautiful uncut hair of the graves. And if you think about it, the only life that stems from a grave is grass, and it's a beautiful concept to connect death and life in that way. But in that same way, he also portrays the idea that life emerges from death, and how young grass emerges from the ground, and death is only the beginning for new life to appear. So this idea of the revolving of the revolving world, and how the men and women of today will lead to the men and the women of tomorrow, and how the world goes on and does not stop for men, and men just inhabit the earth. I think it's very transcendental. I don't know if you come to the same conclusion. I feel very connected to transcendentalism when I read that section. I think it connects very well. The section 15, the pure contralto. I like this part because it talks about different people, and it's like a checklist of everyone, and this is the idea: everyone is equally important in the eyes of God or in the eyes of nature, and in this way, it seems as a very transcendental way again of connecting a divinity and this internal idea of an inner divinity that is superseding the traditional view that we have of an overseeing God or some type of religiousness that is not so clearly expressed, but at the same time it goes over all the people. It tries to make create a picture, a still picture of what American society was like at a certain moment, and for that reason he goes over all the different professions and people and what they're doing at a certain moment. Section 15, the pure contralto sings in the organ loft. Was 16 written before or after the Civil War? Before, I think. No, the whole book. It's, I mean, this whole poem was written before the Civil War. but it was modified afterwards. I think that this section was not included afterwards. Let me see. Yeah, I think that it was clearly before, but I can check that later. The pure contralto sings in the organ loft. The carpenter dresses his plank. The tongue of his foreplane whistles its wild ascending lisp. The married and unmarried children ride home to their Thanksgiving dinner. The pilot seizes a kingpin. He heaves down with a strong arm. The mate stands braced in the whaleboat. Lance and harpoon are ready. The duck shooter walks by silent and cautious stretches. The deacons are ordained with crossed hands at the altar. The spinning girl retreats and advances to the hum of the big wheel. The farmer stops by the bars as he walks on a first day loaf and looks at the oats and rye. The lunatic is carried at last to the asylum, a confirmed case. As you can see, he's mixing and matching peoples of different origins. Some are considered more important for society, others lesser than standard, substandard. He puts them all in the same level. This idea of democracy, this is the idea of a poetic democracy. The lunatic is carried at last to the asylum, a confirmed case. He will never sleep anymore as he did in the cot of his mother's bedroom. The juror printer with gray head and gaunt jaws works at his case. He turns his quid of tobacco while his eyes blur with the manuscript. The malformed limbs are tied to the surgeon's table. What is removed drops horribly in a pail. The quadroon girl is sold at the auction stand. The drunkards nod by the barroom stove. The machinist rolls up his sleeves. The policeman travels his beat. The gatekeeper marks who pass. The young fellow drives the express wagon. I love him, though I do not know him. The half-breed straps on his light boots to compete in the race. The western turkey shooting draws old and young. Some lean on their rifles, some sit on logs. Out from the crowd steps a marksman, takes a position, levels his piece. The group of newly come immigrants cover the wharf or levee. As the holy pates hoe in the sugar fields, the overseer views them from his saddle. The bugle calls in the ballroom. The gentlemen run for their partners. The dancers bow to each other. The youth lies awake in the cedared roof garret and harks to the musical rain. The wolverine sets traps on the creek that helps fill the Huron. The squaw, wrapped in her yellow hemmed cloth, is offering moccasins and beadbags for sales. The connoisseur peers along the exhibition gallery with half-shut eyes bent sideways. As the deckhands make fast as the steamboat, the plank is thrown for the shore-going passengers. The young sister holds out the skein while the elder sister winds it off in a ball and stops now and then for knots. The one-year wife is recovering and happy, having a week ago born her first child. The clean-haired Yankee girl works with her sewing machine or in the factory or mill. The paving man leans on his two-handed rammer. The reporter's lead flies swiftly over the notebook. The sign painter's lettering with blue and gold. The canal boy trots on the towpath. The bookkeeper counts at his desk. The shoemaker waxes his thread. The conductor beats time for the band, and all the performers follow him. The child is baptized. The convert is making his first professions. The regatta is spread on the bay. The race has begun. How the white sails sparkle. The drover watching his drove sings out to them that would stray. The peddler sweats with his pack on his back. The purchaser higgling about the odd scent. The bride unrumples her white dress. The minuteman of the clock moves slowly. The opium eater reclines with rigid head and just open lips. The prostitute draggles her shawl. Her bonnet bobs on her tipsy and pimpled neck. The crowd laugh at her blackguard oath. The man jeer and wink to each other. Miserable, I do not laugh at your oath nor jeer you. The president holding a cabinet council is surrounded by the great secretaries. On the piazza walk three matrons stately and friendly with twinned arms. The crew of the fish smack pack repeated layers of halibut in the hold. The Missourian crosses the plains, toting his wares and his cattle. As a fare collector goes through the train, he gives notice by the jingling of the loose change. The floormen are laying the floor. The tinners are tinning the roof. The masons are calling for mortar. In a single file, each shouldering his hod, pass onward the laborers. Season pursuing each other, the indescribable crowd is gathered. It is the fourth of 7 months. What salutes of cannon and small arms. Season pursuing each other, the plower plows, the mower mows, and the winter grain falls in the ground. As you can see, he's just changed only profession for time. When he says that people gather for the fourth of the seventh month, that's the 4th of July. Off on the lakes, the pike fisher watches and waits by the holes in the frozen surface. The stumps stand thick round the clearing. The squatter strikes deep with his axe. Flat boatmen make fast towards dusk near the cottonwood or pecan trees. Coon seekers go through the regions of the Red River or through those drained by the Tennessee or through those of the Arkansas. Torches shine in the dark that hangs on the Chattahoochee or the Altamaha. Patriarchs sit at supper with sons and grandsons and great-grandsons around them. In walls of adobe, in canvas tents, rest hunters and trappers after their day's sports. The city sleeps and the country sleeps. The living sleep for their time, the dead sleep for their time. The old husband sleeps by his wife and the young husband sleeps by his wife. And these tend inward to me and I tend outward to them. And such as it is to be, of these more or less I am. And of these one and all, I weave the song of myself. As you can see, it's very poetic, of course, how he changes the pace between a description of professions. He includes the dimension of time, and then he includes the dimension at the end of the section of timelessness, of comparing the sleep of one night with the eternal sleep of the dead. So those combined ideas are very interesting and they're very experimental and new. They seem completely different to what we've read so far. Section 16, I am of old and young, of the foolish as much as the wise, regardless of other, ever regardful of others, maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man, stuffed with the stuff that is coarse and stuffed with the stuff that is fine. One of the nation of many nations, the smallest the same, the largest the same. A southerner soon as a northerner. A planter nonchalant and hospitable, down by the Okanoe I live. A Yankee bound by my own was ready for trade. My joints the limberest joints on earth and the sternest joints on earth. A Kentuckian walking the vale of the Elkhorn in my deerskin leggings, a Louisianan or a Georgian, a boatsman over lakes or bays or long coasts, a Hoosier, Badger, Buckeye, at home on Canadian snowshoes, or up in the bush, or with fishermen off Newfoundland, at home in the fleet of ice boats, sailing with the rest and tacking, at home on the hills of Vermont or in the woods of Maine, or the Texan ranch, comrade of Californians, comrade of free Northwesterners, loving their big proportions, comrade of raftsmen and coalsmen, comrade of all who shake hands and welcome to drink and meet, a learner with the simplest, a teacher of the thoughtfulest, a novice beginning yet experiment of myriad of seasons, of every hue and caste am I, of every rank and religion, a farmer, mechanic, artist, gentleman, sailor, Quaker, prisoner, fancy man, rowdy, lawyer, physician, priest. I resist anything better than my own diversity. Breathe the air, but leave plenty after me. And am not stuck up and am in my place. And the moth and the fish eggs are in their place. The bright suns I see and the dark suns I cannot see are in their place. The palpable is in its place and the impalpable is in its place. Section 17. These are really the thoughts of all men in all ages and lands. They are not original with me. If they are not yours as much as mine, they are nothing or next to nothing. If they are not the riddle and the untying of the riddle, they are nothing. If they are not just as close as they are distant, they are nothing. This is the grass that grows wherever the land is and the water is. This is the common air that bathes the globe. I don't know if you have the same feeling when I read this out loud. I do have the feeling that the same feeling that when I read, that when you hear or read a Bible, the cadence of the way the words are distributed, that's very interesting, because it's not coincidence. It's something that's thought that way. The ending of Song of Myself, section 51, the past and present wilt, I have filled them, empty them, and proceed to fill my next fold of the future. Listener up there, what have you to confide to me? Look in my face while I snuff the sidle of evening. Talk honestly, no one else hears you, and I stay only a minute longer. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes. I concentrate towards them that are nigh. I wait on the door slab. Who has done his day's work? Who will soonest be through with his supper? Who wishes to walk with me? Will you speak before I am gone? Will you prove already too late? Okay. And finally, section 52. The more I think about it, the more I think that 16 was way before the Civil War, 1855. Oh, drums of war already. I mean, the Civil War had been looming for a very long time. So 1855, well, I don't know. I would have to look that up. The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I too am not a bit tamed. I too am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. This is part of the audio that I wanted to play for you. The last scud of day holds back for me. It flings my likeness after the rest, and true as any on the shadowed wilds. It coaxes me to vapor and the dusk. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my fleshes in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you. Okay, so as you can see, Song of Myself is elusive in parts, very clear in others, and has this overall feeling of being a very, very multifaceted work. I don't know if you have that same feeling, but this is the feeling that we get as a whole. In the presentation that is uploaded here, it's a PowerPoint presentation. For once, I didn't upload it as a PDF. You can download it, and you can link to the audio files of these sections. And also, the whole poem is available at archive.org. And when Emerson read Leaves of Grass, he wrote him a letter of praise to Whitman, and Whitman had Emerson as one of his biggest influences, and for sure that this was a very important moment in Whitman's career. I think that we can leave it here. I think it's the end of the class has arrived, and the unit has totally changed my opinion on Whitman for the better. Okay, good. I have to admit, this book is the last book I bought before I started to teach American literature. And sometimes, until you don't have to cover an author, until you don't have to explain something, you might not be able to learn it. So I know that sometimes when you cram for exams, you get to the feeling that you understand the author the day before the exam or 2 days before the exam. Well, In my case, I passed this subject. I enjoyed Dickinson very much. I didn't enjoy Whitman that much. But when I had to explain Whitman and actually read his work and read a significant portion of his work and come to understand the motivation behind him, I found newly discovered appreciation. And now I couldn't say whether I preferred Dickinson or Whitman. When I was a student, I definitely preferred Dickinson over Whitman's style. I think that Whitman's style has many things that are beautiful and interesting to read. Dickinson has others, and we'll talk about those next week. Can you upload the presentation from last week? I already did. What I have learned is that you have to listen while you read. Oh, yeah, that's true. Sometimes the style of reading a poem is very important. And in this case, remember, Bible reading, this free flow that we talked about, that's a key word that you have to walk away with. I'm very happy if you say that it was a meaningful lesson. Whitman is one of the most important authors in this term. Have a fantastic week, guys. I'll see you next week. And it's been great to have you. And next week, more quarantine and more American literature. Have a fantastic week.